You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 15th of February 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is The Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up, the world is deep in crisis, and the people we turn to in the hope they will fix it are not up to the job. The depressing message ahead of a major security conference this weekend. We'll try to find a more optimistic one. As Venezuela's crisis continues, we hear from one man arguing the case for change in Canada.
The party is over for Maduro, and it's time to go. But it also is trying to confront the transition and is trying to create the condition for the people to come back to Venezuela and to rebuild the country.
Security is tightened ahead of elections in Nigeria this weekend. We'll look ahead later on and we'll find out how you transplant one of Europe's most famous art fairs to LA. Plus the top stories across Australia and a little music from Sweden. All ahead in the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. Well, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. Dozens of political leaders from around the world are in Munich this weekend for a major security conference. For more than 50 years, this gathering's been a vital opportunity for them to assess the big security challenges that face the world. It is fair to say they meet this year in pretty low spirits, facing warnings of a global crisis and politicians that either aren't up to the job or unwilling to even try. Well, we're going to explore some of the key issues now with Dr. Ulrike Franke, who's a policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and is also part of its new European Security Initiative. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. I mean, in short, the mood of this conference seems to be that political leaders are failing to confront, or even in some cases attempt to confront, the series of major crises that face the world.
Yeah, I think that impression is rather correct. I mean, the Munich Security Report this year was entitled The Great Puzzle, Who Will Pick Up the Pieces? And honestly, you know, after this first day of this conference, no one has stepped forward to even offer that they would try to pick up the pieces. The conference is going to last two more days, so we'll see. But overall, it's been quite striking that it has been very difficult to find anyone who has answers at this point.
In large part, part of that obviously seems to be about Donald Trump. He was saying not just what Donald Trump is doing himself and the impact that's having on US policy, but also the impact it's having on the US position as a global leader.
Yeah, I mean, that being said, in a way, the United States and Donald Trump wasn't such a big point of discussion today. Actually, the United States has been represented here in Munich with the largest delegation ever. So we have U.S. Vice President Mike Pence here, many, many senators, congressmen, congresswomen. So in a way, you know, the United States, or just some people in the United States, are really trying to show that the transatlantic relationship is still, you know, up there and fighting. So I don't really think that all of this is due to Donald Trump. It's just that there are many crises at the moment. Yes, the United States is kind of abdicating this role of a global leader, and no one else seems to be stepping forward. And especially here in Munich, I mean, Munich is always focused on European security and the transatlantic relationship. And yeah, that at the moment isn't particularly good looking.
Well, you mentioned that Mike Pence is at the head of that significant US delegation. He's there. He's going to hear all of these people talk about the need for global leadership, the need for politicians to step up, and implicit criticisms of the United States and its position since Donald Trump became president. But it's not very likely to make any difference, is it really?
No, and that's the thing. This is what I really found quite striking today, and we'll see whether this continues tomorrow. But so it is well known that at the Munich Security Conference, a lot of important things happen outside of the conference room, right, in these so-called bilaterals, the bilateral meetings. But that being said, this year I found it particularly striking just how empty the conference room was during most of the sessions. I mean, you have really, really high-level politicians sitting up there on panels talking about things, and the room is two-thirds empty. And the reason for that is not that people are staying away from the conference. On the contrary, there hasn't have never been that many high-level leaders at the conference. But basically, people are outside in the hallway talking among each other, trying to find solutions there. So I don't think that the kind of the big outcomes of this conference will come from, you know, the panel, from the speeches, from the official part, but more outside. That's where the delegations, the people, the representatives are going to try to find solutions.
Now, the sort of the agenda for the conference and for those discussions that happen outside, presumably, is sort of set partly in this big report that gets published before everyone arrives in Munich, and it highlights all sorts of issues. Another one is concerns about the European Union, which it says is particularly ill-prepared for the future.
Yeah, so the report, as you say, it comes out every year, has so for the last 5 years, the Munich Security Report, always a great read. It's available online, so everyone can have a look. And it's really good at bringing together interesting information and graphs about, you know, what countries are able to do militarily, that kind of thing. And you're right, the report highlights European defense quite a lot, and it highlights that, well, the European Union, isn't necessarily as prepared as it should be for the kinds of crises that are coming up. I mean, this isn't exactly news, right? This is something that we know of. A lot of countries are trying to change that. I just listened to Federica Mogherini, the EU High Representative for Foreign Policy. She tried to kind of strike an upbeat note. Didn't go that down that well with the audience, I have to say. But on that European Union thing, so one of the kind of highlights of the conference so far has been seeing Wolfgang Ischinger, who leads the conference. He's a former German ambassador to the United States and has led the conference for many years now. And he actually appeared on stage in a European Union hoodie. So he opened the conference not in suit and tie as one normally would, but he was wearing a hoodie with the European Union flag on it, which was quite a statement. And that you know, caused some you know, laughter and debate, and you know, he really tried to strike this upbeat mood.
One thing that it also talks about is how the failure of nations like, say, the United States or institutions like the EU to be able to fulfill those leadership roles successfully creates an opportunity, a sort of a vacuum, that could be filled by other countries. And it mentions Canada and Japan. It also mentions the UK, which is perhaps a surprise given the massive self-obsession within the UK over Brexit.
Yeah, so on these kind of, let's say, mid-sized power, it's especially the German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, who has really tried to build up this idea of an alliance of multilateralists, an alliance of medium-sized powers that would combine countries, you know, such as the European countries with Japan, with Australia, all the countries that you mentioned. I'm not really sure whether this is working out as well yet as he's hoping it will. We'll see how that's gonna work. On the United Kingdom, it is interesting because this year the conference was opened by Wolfgang Ischinger, of course, but also by Ursula von der Leyen, the German defense minister, together with Gavin Williamson, the British defense minister. And, you know, that was supposed to be a kind of sign, a signal that the UK is still involved in European defense. But it didn't seem to work as well as one would have hoped. And to be quite honest, so Williamson already gave his talk here, and a lot of people basically said that it was behind expectations, that it was a bit boring, that there wasn't that much in it. So at this point, I don't think that the UK is, you know, in such a great situation here in Munich. I mean, everyone knows the UK is self-absorbed over Brexit, and that is also visible here in Munich, I think.
I thought this was a particularly damning quote in this report. It says, some of the candidates for an increased role as guardians of the liberal order are willing but incapable. That could be the UK, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Others are at least moderately capable but unwilling or unable to bring their capabilities to the fore. You put those two things together, that's a pretty depressing state of affairs.
Yes. Yes, that is true. And this is a problem that has plagued European defence for a while. It wasn't such a big issue in the past because we could always be certain that the United States would step up, come in. be there. We can no longer be sure of that. And this is what makes all of this so urgent. This is why there are now so many initiatives with regard to European defense in Europe, in the EU, because people realize that this really is becoming an issue and we can't be sure that the United States is always going to be there to pick up the pieces.
Ulrike, thank you very much. Ulrike Franke is from the European Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, once again, Venezuela's embattled leader has refused to allow aid convoys into his country. Nicolas Maduro has called them a ruse, cover for an international takeover of the nation. Among those watching the unfolding crisis from afar is Olinda Vieira Blanco, who last week was formally recognised by Canada as the first overseas ambassador to Juan Guaido, the self-declared interim Venezuelan president. Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, went to meet him, and they started by discussing the latest developments in Venezuela.
It's a crisis. It's the worst crisis, social, political, economic crisis in the whole life of my country. So we are in the so complex situation. We're trying to, again, to restore freedom and democracy and restore rule of law. In Venezuela, we have no order in our country. The whole country, the whole institution, the whole state had been dismantled. The whole state is absent, is the absence of the state. So is the recovery of institutions, is the recovery of people trying to live together again, to return to the normal life.
And why, in your mind, is Juan Guaido the right man to lead Venezuela into a new chapter, free from the current regime of Nicolas Maduro?
He's a humble man. That is very important. In order to inspire not just a sector of the population, it's just to inspire the whole population, the humble people as well, because that is very important in the process to reintegrate our society. What happened in Venezuela in the last few years, it was that we have an opposition that in some way represents some sector, some portion of the population, even though it's a democratic opposition. The propaganda and Chavez in that moment with a lot of money just create a polarization in Venezuela, a division in Venezuela. And what happened right now is that Mr. Guaido represents such alternative, such hope. National forces right now is with the people, is part of the people, is suffering the suffering of the people. And that means that is some kind of breakpoint to Mr. Maduro.
You are also the head of a group that represents Venezuelans in Canada. You hosted a meeting here in Toronto last night. What's the mood within Venezuelans who are living in Canada, looking at what's happening at their country from here?
The mood is like a wake-up, like a sunrise. It's like a light is not more at the end of the tunnel. The light is just in the front. And it's just coming. It's like the awakening of Venezuela to the recovery of a country and the hope maybe to get back to our country. That's the mood of the people right now in the diaspora.
And you were at the latest Lima Group meeting in Ottawa maybe last week. How confident are you that a group like the Lima Group can be successful in doing what it's trying to do, so in creating sort of provisions for a peaceful transition of power in Venezuela? Is there enough momentum there? Is there enough cohesion between this quite disparate collection of countries on a way forward that doesn't seem to be meddling in Venezuela's affairs, but that kind of gives a solid way forward?
That is another very good question. When you see a phenomenon, a political phenomenon like happened in Venezuela in the last years, and a state that in some way has been kidnapped by, as I'm saying, like an absence state, by some kind of group of people without any institutional behavior, it's not easy to try to get out from here, to step down such government. We're going to get liberty, freedom. That is a phenomenon. That is something, it's not romantic, it's a reality. Venezuela has been fighting for freedom in the last, mostly in the last 5 years, very strongly, since 2014. And people don't stop. I'm sure that in this opportunity, the whole world is going to see the restoration of democracy in Venezuela without the intervention of this kind of military forces of any kind of war. This is the people defending by themselves. The agenda is not to reduce everything about US, Mr. Trump, or a potential war. No, no, no. It's something bigger.
And that's Orlando Vieira Blanco, who represents Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido in Canada, speaking there to Thomas Lewis. You're with The Daily from Monocle 24. Stay with us in just a moment. We'll look forward to the elections this weekend in Nigeria.
Tired of seeing the same few tedious tourist haunts?
Well, the Monocle Travel Guide series has stopped off in 30-plus cities and counting in order to dispense advice on travelling like a local. From the finest spot in which to sip a cocktail with a contact, work up a sweat, or take a dip. Our comprehensive travel guide series are packed with tips, essays, and tidbits for getting the very best from your destination. Monocle's travel guide series is published by Gestalten, the Monocle Travel Guide series. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Now, security has been tightened across Nigeria ahead of Saturday's presidential election. This is no surprise in a country where past elections have been marred by violence and allegations of vote rigging. In one state, Kaduna, authorities have reported at least 66 deaths in a wave of pre-election violence. 22 of the victims were children. The sitting president, Muhammadu Buhari, faces a challenge from a former vice president, Atiku Abubakar. Well, to look ahead now, I'm joined by Imed Mesdour, who's a senior consultant for Africa at Control Risks. Thank you for joining us. Mr. Buhari was elected promising that he would boost the economy, he would fight corruption, and he would defeat Islamist militants. Now, critics say he's failed on all three. Is that fair?
Well, I think the case that President Muhammadu Buhari is making, has been making throughout this campaign, is that a lot of progress has been achieved, but there's a lot more that can be done, and that should be done. Certainly, a lot of the criticism that's been pointed towards his administration since he was elected in 2015 was, you know, mainly centered on efficiency, on speed, on getting things done. You know, the nickname that he was given very early on in his administration was Baba Goslow, which was, you know, very pointed critique at the fact that it took a long time for him to set up his first cabinet, around 8 months. But in reality, there has been some progress in quite a few areas that President Buhari campaigned on. I'm thinking particularly on the issues of security, for example, where the current administration can point to real successes in the northeast of Nigeria, where Boko Haram has lost a lot of territory that it used to control, particularly, you know, in states like Adamawa, Yobe, and Borno. So there are some successes. There are also a lot of challenges. And the main kind of driver of this current campaign from Muhammadu Buhari's perspective has been to say to voters, I need more time to complete the projects that have been made in infrastructure, for example, in the fight against corruption, and as you mentioned, security as well.
Now, tell us a little more about his rival candidate.
So Atiku Abubakar is also a known quantity, a known political quantity in Nigeria. He's been in government for many, many years. Between 1999 and 2000, he served as the vice president of the Federal Republic under former President Olusegun Obasanjo, and has been in many respects a kind of political nomad. He first served inside the ruling PDP party, the People's Democratic Party, when he was vice president, joined the opposition in later years and supported President Buhari when he ran for president in 2015 and has since returned to the PDP, of which he is the flag bearer. That there are a lot of... So he does have supporters on both sides of the aisle. He does have support in the north. And this is going to make the election quite competitive, quite tight.
How do you rate Mr. Buhari's chances of being re-elected?
Well, he does have some significant advantages. He is the incumbent and as such wields the kind of levers of state, both in terms of the ability to set the agenda. He's used the last few weeks to his ability as his role as president, commander in chief, to put out national addresses, for example, which many have criticized were perhaps not appropriate, given that this is a campaign season. And also, President Buhari benefits from the fact that within the PDP, the opposition party, there are a lot of senior figures that ran for the primary to represent the party and lost to it. And so they will have powerful constituencies and big constituencies that might hold off from voting for Atiku as a result of these big kind of power brokers not having a shot at the presidency. So he benefits in that respect. However, Atiku is putting out a strong message of change and saying that this current administration promised many things in 2015. It won a historical election and got... and unseated the PDP, which had been in power for 16 years, but has failed to meet a lot of the promises that were made and has been particularly strong on the issue of the economy because Atiku has painted himself and has been a kind of business magnate and is, saying all the right things in terms of the kinds of reforms that people who are now critical of Buhari are expecting or wanting. So it is a competitive election, but for the time being, as a result of the dynamics I mentioned earlier, President Buhari seems to have the upper hand, given the fact that he is the incumbent and, wields those levers of state.
One reporter who's been covering this campaign said that it was one where, in their words, fake news had been weaponized. At one point, Mr. Buhari had to deny that he had died and had been replaced by a clone. It sounds like it's been a slightly interesting campaign.
Yes, there has been a lot of rumors. There's been a lot of false news, or fake news, as some are calling it. It has been a very kind of competitive campaign. And we've seen this in the past. There's been a lot of, mutual accusations of, as I said, conflicts of interest and corruption within the parties. Nigerian campaigns tend to be quite, quite competitive, as I mentioned, this one in particular. And as a result, you start to see run up to, election day. A lot of accusations being traded and a lot of news coming from his otherwise a very vocal press locally to support either candidate. And you have these big constituencies, these brokers that can behind the scenes kind of trade jabs, these kinds of issues. So very competitive election. And I guess it's further proof that, the possibility of a kind of tight result is high.
Imad, thank you very much. Imad Mastua is from Control Risks. In just a moment on the Monocle Daily, we'll talk about art in Los Angeles. But first, let's catch up with some of the day's other top news stories. Donald Trump's confirmed he'll use emergency powers to release funding for a border wall. He's made the controversial move after Congress refused to fund the program. It'll give him access to billions of dollars towards wall construction. But Democrats have called it a gross abuse of power, with some threatening to challenge the move in the courts. Spain's prime minister's called a snap election for the 28th of April. It's just 8 months since Pedro Sanchez took office at the head of a government which has depended on the support of nationalist Catalan MPs. They've withdrawn that support over the government's budget. Polls suggest no single party will win a clear majority in the election. And Britain's Prince Charles is to become the first member of the royal family to visit Cuba next month. The visit's part of a wider tour, but the trip to the communist-run country is bound to attract the most attention. Charles is due to return to the UK on the 29th of March, the day it's due to leave the European Union. This is the Monocle Daily. Well, next we turn to art, specifically to Frieze, the London-based art fair, which has launched its first ever Los Angeles event today. It's being staged inside the Paramount Pictures lot. Well, Monocle's Chiara Ramella is there and earlier spoke to Kulapat Yenfrasat from the studio design studio Y. He designed the entire event in LA, a process that started with working out how you improve one of the world's most successful art events.
Well, I think that's a very good question. Frieze, of course, not in London and in New York, right? And when you come to LA, the tent itself is smaller than New York or London. But I think it's something very special because as LA, we have such a strong art communities. So I want this to feel very intimate and really focus on the artists, you know, rather than, let's say, the market, shall we say. And the other thing is because basically half the fair is in the tent, the other half is in the back lot, which is the restaurants and the lounges and the artist projects and things. So the connection between the two is quite important. So it might be maybe the very first indoor-outdoor fair. I've been to a lot of fairs and most of them are not indoor-outdoor at all. You get into, you know, in a way, it felt like you've been in a supermarket, right? And I felt like this one is, it feels like the farmer's market. You know, the artists who make the work actually walk in the fair. You don't see a lot of fairs that artists want to go. I mean, they're really dreading it as like the supermarket aspect of it. But here you see, you know, as we were just walking, we see Jonas Wu, we see Shio, we see many artists who live in LA who actually come to support their own work and their artists, their friends. I think that has a beautiful, beautiful feel about it that I've never seen in an art fair in a long time. And in terms of design, one thing that I tried to do is to make people feel very comfortable in the fair. And one thing we did was, you know, the corridor, which has a reverse perspective. So when you come in, the tent itself is around 325 feet long. And when you come in, the corridor have around almost 40 feet wide. And it tapered to almost towards around 12, 20 in the back. So when you come in, you feel like it's very expansive. You know, it tricked the eye a little bit, and it make the fair very manageable. Not only that, it's all the store fronts, all the galleries to be visible the minute you walked in, right? So that gives the sense of accessibility and the sense of easy to orient yourself within the space.
Another thing that's interesting is that we're inside a tent. We could virtually be anywhere, but we are in LA. How do you transmit that to people? There are subtle details that point a little bit to the surroundings, and also we're in a very symbolic place, LA-wise.
Absolutely. I think, you know, first of all, when you come to the front of the tent, right, there's a sense of nature, both real and artificial, allow you to get to that place, greeneries, you know, an outdoor entrance, and you come into this entrance which is made up of these blue walls, which, you know, in my design, it comes from the structure behind the Hollywood sign. When you see the scaffoldings, you see the frames, right? So we kind of elevate that framing and create this sense that when you come in here, you feel like you're in a working studio, which Paramount is. As you walk in today, you see that people are working, people are moving sets and, you know, doing costumes and things. It's a living studio, and so it feels quite vibrant in that sense. I like that notion that things are not really being presented. Things are being, in a way, as they are, and you just happen to be part of it. You know, so I think that call is important. One thing that we really insist on is really the translucent roof, which, I mean, if you're here early on today, you know, when a cloud passed by, when it rained or the sun, it changed the room completely. People were looking at it, I was like, oh, you know exactly what the weather outside is, right? Because the tent is really transferring. But I mean, there's nothing better than natural light in the fair. And of course, there's risk involved, rain, sun, and all of the other things. But, you know, I think we all take that risk because we felt like the best way to look at art is under natural light. So I think that was the key to it.
it's very interesting. We were walking around the fair and lots of gallerists were stopping you and saying, you know, congratulations, this withstood the rain this morning. Because in a very, very uncommon thing for Los Angeles, this morning was raining so hard. So how do you prepare for even those kind of freak moments? You've got, on the one side, these very intelligent kind of air conditioning benches spread across the fair, but then also you need to have a tent that can withstand even the harshest of rains.
Yes, I mean, we were suspecting that it would rain this week, right? We hope it would not, but we were preparing for the worst. So the tent system, we work with engineers that really make sure. The wind today, this morning, was quite severe. I was really quite concerned. I text with my freeze team here, it's like, everything's okay, no leak, everything's fine. I mean, it's like, wow, this is great. And of course, you know, we also want to make sure that there's a level of temperature control that really allow people to be comfortable within. So all of that is really taken very seriously by the freeze team and by our design team. So I think that's a big part of it. One thing that we were concerned about is, of course, the galleries are in the tent, but the rest of the fair is in the back lot, which is mostly outdoor, including even newsstand, bookstores, you know, a museum shop, artist project, which is just so profound. I haven't been to any fair, it's not to my credit, but to Ali as a curator. I've never been to any art fair that has that level of artist projects. You know, it truly integrates into the fair experience. Sometimes you go to a fair and outside the fair, there's a ground where sculptures are located. Right, and this is the sculptures. It really integrate into that. It's not only sculpture. It have programming, psychic reading, retail by artists, intervention, Tino Segal moment. It's amazing, amazing experience. And going back to what you say exactly is that it happened in this back lot, which is a fake city. Right, you go around and you see that fake city. If you turn to the right, you see actually people shooting movie. Right, and you see artists are playing with these Hollywood memories. All the artists in the back lot are playing from memories from movies that they're playing with. It's all this weird movie, real life, in action. I think it's a profound experience.
And that's Kulapati Yantrasastoff, Y, the design studio, speaking to Chiara Ramella at Freeze in Los Angeles. And the fair continues until Sunday. Now, a little earlier, we explored a conference that's discussing the world's big security challenges. Next, we're going to hear from a journalist and author who's written about the threats to many democracies. Ece Temelkuren's book is called How to Lose a Country, The 7 Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship. She's from Turkey and earlier told Tom Edwards about the main factor behind writing the book.
Well, actually, out of boredom. No, seriously, I was so bored of this excess of emotions because, as you are experiencing in this country because of Brexit, in Turkey, people, and including me, we have been exhausted by excess of emotions due to the political turmoil. At some point, one starts thinking there must be a main mechanism, there must be a main logic to what's happening around us. And what is most needed, I thought, right now for entire world is clarity. People are exhausted of being confused. And I think people are exhausted of politics being reduced to some sort of miserable dichotomies like Brexiteers or anti-Brexiteers and so on. So actually, the book gathers the experience from Turkey, but then it projects this experience to European countries and United States. And I try to give the main logic, the fundamental mechanism of right-wing populism, how it works, how it thinks, how it speaks, how it behaves, so everybody can save the time and energy. Because we didn't have the chance in Turkey to do that. We were one of the first experiments, so to speak. And now it's creeping to other countries. They are in the very beginning of the process, but they have to know what's coming towards them. That's why I wrote the book. And also, I now know that rising right-wing populism cannot be beaten only in one country. It really requires a global discussion and global solidarity. And I wanted to bring people into this discussion, conversation, and hopefully solidarity. That's why I wrote the book.
And it's interesting what you said there. There was always this feeling that this was a sort of an insidious, a creeping development yeah. politically. It seems more and more brazen now. It's not that it creeps into their countries. They almost seem to be inviting it in. Can the book, or should the book, serve as a sort of a primer of resistance? Or is it about how to prepare for this happening? I don't know. Is there a distinction to make there, really?
Yeah. Mostly invites people to take a step back. Because even though they are exhausted in Britain, they're exhausted by Brexit. In France, they are shocked by yellow vests. And in several other countries, it's similar things. So before they know it, they find themselves in this dichotomy, in this polarization. So actually, How to Lose a Country invites them to take a step back and warns them about the exhaustion that they might experience if they fall into this dichotomy, if they fall into this turmoil. So is it a call for resistance? Well, why not?
Well, we don't probably have enough, do we?
Yeah.
Well, do we? I don't know.
Well, I'm like, people think like to think that, oh, this is good. People are politically engaged. There is more political discussion. People are energized and so on. But I don't think that that's politics. It is running on two choices only. Either you're one of them or you're against them. And this is not politics. And I think we have to resist against this idea more than anything else. So this book is a resistance to be reduced into Brexiteers or non-Brexiteers, or, you know, against the yellow vests or for yellow vests, or, you know, against Alternative für Deutschland, populist party in Germany, or being against that. So, you know, the book is resistance against the disruption of rationale, which is one of the common patterns of rising right-wing populism on global level.
Now, I've heard you, it was interesting, that reminds me of a thing I've seen you say before about politics and your frustration with people who say, oh, understandably perhaps, oh, I hate politics, I've had enough.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You say, this is the most, it's not binary, it's not that you hate it or you like it, and to hate politics is the most politically charged comment that you can possibly make. Is there a public misperception about what their own animosity towards the political class is? And actually, they don't hate politics, they don't hate the whole notion of it. They just hate the current practitioners. And maybe we need to all be, and I guess the book talks a bit about this, we need to be a bit more demanding of our political personnel as well.
Yeah. One of the funny things about those people who say, oh, I hate politics, is that they are not aware that this is not their individual idea, individual choice. Actually, this is an argument, this is a motto, let's say. This is a motto that has been imposed on us starting from late 1970s. So people were made to forget that they were political subjects. Therefore, they became political objects, in fact. So as neoliberalism is considered to be a non-ideology, as if, I hate politics is considered to be a non-political motto, where actually it is completely the opposite. One of the things that How to Lose a Country tries to tell people that, okay, that's not politics. To start with, you know, watching politicians fighting each other is not following politics. And politics is much richer and much sexier than that. And one of the things, one of the subtitles of this issue, so to speak, is about women. There is this misconception about political books and women. The entire publishing industry thinks that women do not read political books. Whereas I do think that more than ever, women are more interested in politics because they are like the coal mine canaries, so to speak. They are feeling the clothes of political malady before anyone else. So they are more and more interested in politics. So I think it is the women who should be saying no whenever someone says, oh, I hate politics. No, you love politics, in fact. When you really do that, when you really do politics, when you really speak politics, you'll know that you'll like it.
And that's Etietemel Kudan speaking to Tom Edwards about that new book, How to Lose a Country. You can hear more of that in the new edition of the Monocle Weekly. It premieres at midday London time this Sunday on Monocle 24. A Well, we shift our focus to Australia now as we take a look at some of the stories that are making the headlines there. My guest in the studio is Phil Clark, who's a reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, University of London. Phil, thank you very much for coming in this evening.
Evening.
We begin with a story that I find absolutely fascinating. Very old story, very old scandal in Australian politics.
Indeed. This is the issue of 1975 in Australia. This is a piece on the Channel 9 website looking at a range of letters that have been uncovered. Letters between the Governor-General, John Kerr, and Her Majesty the Queen. The thing about 1975 is that this is the only time in Australian history that the Queen's representative basically dissolved a democratically elected government. This was a Labor government. It was the first Labor government in about 40 years. So this, particularly for people on the left in Australian politics, is a real sort of sore point. People talk about 1975 in very dark tones. The key in this story this week is that a tranche of letters has been uncovered between the Governor-General and the Queen, and the suspicion is that the Queen and the monarchy knew a lot more about the attempt to get rid of that government than they've ever let on. There's been a high court case that's gone on now for 2 or 3 years trying to get access to these letters so that we can better understand exactly what went on around the dismissal of the Whitlam government. And just in the last few days, the Australian Federal Court has ruled that, in fact, those letters cannot be released into the public domain. So this will only fuel suspicion, I think, about a conspiracy in 1975 to get rid of this leftist government.
I remember watching a documentary about this, but I was in Australia once randomly, and they talked about how you couldn't do this now if for no other reason than the circumstances in which the then Prime Minister was sort of driven in and sacked. And the opposition leader was kind of waiting round the back in another car to be taken in. And now they said, well, now you'd have a news helicopter up and you'd instantly go, well, what's he doing there? And the whole thing would be off before it had even started.
That's right. And it's, I mean, the convention of the day was that if two bills of supply had been blocked in Parliament, the convention was that that bill got knocked around in Parliament until there was a resolution. I mean, it was an absolute no-no that you would dismiss a democratically elected government. I think in Australia, the reason that this issue still resonates is that it taps into this whole set of debates about how are we still a constitutional monarchy in 2019, effectively ruled by a foreign head of state. Isn't it time that we got our act together and became a republic? And those on the monarchist side tend to say, well, the head of state is very benign. The Queen doesn't meddle in Australian affairs. Those on the Republican side say, but yes, we have 1975, which was a categorical moment of the Queen and the Queen's representative, the Governor-General, dismissing a government that had twice been elected by the Australian people. This shows you the kind of unaccountable overreach that you can get from an unelected head of state. So this is a really key moment in terms of Australian debates about the monarchy and the republic.
Let's move on from, say, a historical political story to one that's very much of the present, the never-ending arguments over asylum and the detention of asylum seekers and Australia's attitude to them.
No, I mean, it's still staggering, I think, to see just how difficult the Australian Parliament finds it to deal with anything to deal with refugees and asylum seekers. So the latest story, which is being reported on the ABC website in the last 24 hours, is that the Australian Parliament this week did pass legislation that allows asylum seekers who are on two islands, Manus Island and Nauru, to be transferred to Australia if their medical condition is considered serious enough. Now, it might seem to the rest of the world that it's crazy that we're even having a debate about this, but this is an extremely contentious issue in Australia, and it's taken some courage by the Labor Party, in fact, to try to push this legislation through. The government has tried to block this legislation. They are, in essence, saying that the transfer of patients from these islands means that criminals will now be getting easy access to the Australian mainland, and it kind of undermines their sort of anti-asylum seeker policy more broadly. But the bill has gone through. It now looks like something like 300 asylum seekers have been medically vetted as requiring a very serious treatment on the Australian mainland. And so I think finally we've gotten to some kind of humane and humanitarian decision, but it's taken a lot of fighting to get to that point.
How has the sort of the centre point of Australian political discourse shifted in this way, that even just discussing medically evacuating people who are ill enough to require treatment on the mainland, that's contentious?
Yeah, I mean, this really shows just how virulent this issue has become in Australian politics. And it's taken, unfortunately, two suicides by asylum seekers on Manus Island and Nauru to push the parliament to this position. And we've seen the right-wing press in Australia frothing at the mouth over the last few weeks, basically accusing the Labor Party of using this medical issue as a way to soften Australia's stance on asylum seekers. Now, the context here is that we are building up to a federal election in Australia in May. And the right-wing parties, including the Conservative government at the moment, whenever they have felt pushed into a corner, they have always played the immigration, the asylum, the refugee card, and have tended to accuse the Labor Party and the Greens and other groups on the left of being way too soft on refugees and asylum seekers, who are often seen as a synonym for terrorists. And so Labor finally have grown a bit of a spine on this issue and have pushed through this this Medivac legislation this week. But it's sad, I think, to see over the last few years just how much Labor have just been in lockstep with the government on almost any policy to deal with refugees and asylum seekers. So this has been a long time coming from the Labor Party.
You mentioned that elections are coming. Just very briefly before we wrap up, it's been a particularly odd week, hasn't it, in Australian politics?
No, I mean, even by the standards of Australian politics, this has been quite remarkable. So we had fisticuffs between two right-wing senators on Wednesday night, leading into Thursday. A senator called Brian Bernstein, who has been accused of sexual harassment last year. In retaliation, he then accused the leader of the One Nation Party, Pauline Hanson, who's very well known around the world for all the wrong reasons, of sexually harassing him. He claimed that she rubbed his back provocatively during the national anthem.
Good Lord.
And if that's not a sexy move, then I don't know what is.
What sexy than the Australian national anthem?
I mean, girt by sea, I think, is the phrase in the anthem that tends to set the pulse racing. And then in retaliation for these allegations against Hanson, her staffer, a guy called James Ashby, then sort of engaged in a violent act with Bernstein just outside of Parliament.
It's never dull, is it?
It's really not. And Bernstein ended up with a bandage and smeared blood across the door of Pauline Hanson. So it's been a delightful week in Australian politics.
What a lovely week. Phil, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Phil Clark. It's Friday, and that means it's the Global Countdown. This week, Fernando Augusto Pacheco now guides Tom Edwards through the tunes of the week in Sweden.
Well, it's that time of the week again, Fernando. Global Countdown. Where are we alighting this Friday?
We're going to Sweden, Tom. And as you know, it's midwinter there in Sweden. So I have to be honest, I mean, there's some interesting songs here and there, but it's quite a bleak top five, in my opinion. It's interesting because the Scandis, they know how to do nice, bubbly electropop, but God, they know how to go bleak as well.
And that's funny because I guess you expect sometimes music to be immune to the vagaries of the season. But it'll be interesting to reflect if there is a sort of a wintry, long night aspect. I guess we will discover that when we hear what's in the top five. Let's get to it. Number five.
Number five, we have a local rapper called Einar. And the song's called Katten I Trokten, which I translated as Cat in the Funnel. I mean, that's quite funny, but, you know, when you listen to the track, which we're going to hear now, it doesn't sound that funny. Let's hear it.
I mean, it's a slightly somber-sounding track.
It's very somber. And, you know, for those who say, oh, but Sweden does hip-hop as well, they have a very long tradition since the 80s. You know, they had some excellent groups. And some of them, they can be quite political. But I have a feeling this one is not that political. I think it's very much about kind of bling-bling, some mention of drugs here and there.
Okay.
And in fact, number four...
Is that what Cat in the Funnel? Is it some kind of drugs reference?
Yeah. If there's any Swedes listening, do let us know what's Cat in Trokten, in a way. My Swedish is not as good, Tom, for now.
We should have researched that maybe in more detail.
Exactly.
Or perhaps not, actually, as the case may be.
Exactly.
As you say, though, rather somber in tone, perhaps fitting for the time of year, as we said, sort of murky evenings and all the rest. Any rays of sunshine falling elsewhere in the top five?
Not at all, because the next song, number four, is called Kal, which is cold.
Oh, okay.
And it's another very bleak rap song, perhaps even bleaker than Einar. It's Ant One with Kal or Cold. Mama, I'm a drug dealer. Marijuana, cocaína. Vito lives some totorina. Vira que rovelina. Live it to break us, devolinha sem a grina. Mama, I'm a drug dealer. Marijuana, cocaína. Vito lives some totorina. Vira que rovelina. Live it to break us. I mean,
Fernando, my Swedish isn't that good either, but I did seem to be able to pick up just approximately what he was talking about there.
Yeah, very much so.
Is there a theme developing, perhaps?
There is a theme.
Are we learning about how certainly maybe the next generation of Swedes are coping with the long winter evenings?
I wonder if there's a social critique there behind these interesting lyrics.
Very subtle indeed.
Oh, Tom, we need some light, right?
I think... Possibly, if you can.
Well, let's go for the biggest pop star of the moment, Ariana Grande. She was on the news because she refused to go to the Grammys because she had an idea for how her concert, her performance at the show was going to be. But then there was some little discussions with the producer. Apparently, the Grammys producer wanted her to do a medley of her biggest hits. And she said, no, I want to play my new single, which is the one we're going to hear now. So yeah, and she's quite powerful because in the end, people were talking about her not going to the Grammys. Mm. She even wore the costume she was going to wear in the show in her house and she posted on her social media. So that's quite interesting. But let's hear it. Ariana Grande, Seven Rings.
And now, one of the things that probably will impress most people about Ariana Grande is she's really pumping these albums out.
Yes.
That's like two or three in, well, it can only be a little over a year. Is that the new, is this the future for the big chart favourites, do you think?
It is. She's very much in control and she announced those things very last minute. Because in the past, we say, oh, yes, Ariana Grande will release a new album in November. You know, she's just churning out all those singles. And I have to say, the quality, she's pretty
popular and her public likes them. And I wonder, how has she been able to leverage this position? Because you alluded to it there with her view of the Grammys. And we know that she has a sort of an interesting position here in the UK, much of which is tragic, of course, related to the terror attack that happened at her concert in the northwest of England. But what, is she just very canny with how she operates brand Ariana Grande around the world?
She's very canny and genuine. And I mean, of course, I'm sure there's a bunch of PRs around her. But she makes it sound that it's not like that, you know, that she's, you know, she speaks her own mind and that, you know, she makes her own decisions, including not going to the Grammys, for example, or even, you know, hosting that amazing event she did in Manchester after the unfortunate terrorist attack that happened there. I'm a big fan. And I wonder, I mentioned that she was one of the biggest pop stars of the moment. Well, some people might say that's not the case. Perhaps some people might say that is Lady Gaga, which is, again, another performer that I admire quite a lot because she was, at some point, she was becoming quite, you know, weird with those mid dresses and say, what next? And then she stripped down and now she's very respected in Hollywood after being the lead actress in A Star is Born. And, well, shall we hear a track, actually, from the film, Shallows, Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. Let's hear it.
Fernando singing along there. I don't know if you caught the end of that. That's a bit of a a change of pace in the top five. That's at number two, of course, in Sweden at the moment.
And again, I love that song. To be honest, I was not such a big fan of the film, but I think Shallow is such a good pop song, because even if you don't like it, you almost end up singing along at the end. And this song has been 19 weeks in the chart, so it's holding very well, not only in Sweden, but all over the world, I would say. And it's a fantastic song, and I think Lady Gaga is a very much a talented singer. Bradley Cooper as well, I mean, we should say, and he directed the film as well.
Exactly, so he's got enough plaudits for the sort of the screen part of it. But Lady Gaga proving, yeah, crossover appeal, whether it's in the charts or in Hollywood and all the rest. That does lead us, though, you're talking, Faye, it's award season, not just in Hollywood, but around the world. What's top of the pile in Sweden this week?
A very unusual pop star, and the lyrics are very dark and violent, and the video clip has even some needles in it. It's tough, but and I'm very surprised how is it doing so well in Sweden, in the US, and much more. She's American. Let's hear it. It's Billie Eilish with Bury a Friend.
Careful. Step on the glass, step on your tongue, bury a friend. Try to wake up. Cannibal clash, killing the sun. Bury a friend. I wanna end me. I wanna end me.
Oh, Faye, that sounds a bit morbid, doesn't it?
It is morbid.
My sensibilities.
And I'm very much surprised, you know, even though I do read a lot about pop music, for some reason. Yeah, Billie Eilish never came to my on my notes, but then she's doing so well, Tom. And again, she's another artist that, you know, for example, the radio in the US, they're not playing her tracks, but the streaming of her songs is immense. And that's why she's, I think, number 14 in the American singles chart this week, number one in Sweden. So she has a huge online following. And she's quite unusual. I mean, this is a strange song. I mean, when you go to on the radio, you wouldn't, cool, you might hear Ariana or Lady Gaga, but that. Mm. I mean, and I don't hate it. I think it's interesting, you know. And
a winning endorsement from Fernando. Yeah. Well, I don't hate it.
No, honestly, I think Billie Eilish, good.
If we take a step back and just look at that top five, it is, I mean, it is funny. We're talking about it, you know, it's a sort of gloomy time of the year, but there's real light and shade in there. There's a bit of old-fashioned, catchy chart fun with Lady Gaga and a bit of Ariana Grande. And then some pretty kind of challenging material. But I guess maybe that speaks to the modern condition almost. It's the same in Sweden as anywhere else.
Exactly. I love having an unusual number one such as this. But yeah, you know, if your listeners are going out Friday night, perhaps they might want something a bit, you know.
Something to put a spring in their step.
Exactly.
Rather than leave them bolted in their house. Fernando with the Global Countdown. Thanks as always.
It's always a winning endorsement when someone describes a song as that. Fernando Augusto Pacheco there with Tom Edwards. That's it for this Monocle Daily, produced by Tom Hall and Carlotta Rabella. Our researchers were Daphne Karnesis and Teresa Mufuli. And Sarah Miles was our studio manager. The Daily returns 2200 London time on Monday. From me, Paul Osborne. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.